Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Well, this will show you how much clout I have. I invited representatives from the Obama and McCain campaigns to debate which one of them would be better for American employees and employers. And both campaigns said they'd get back to me. Neither one did. I then decided the topic was interesting enough that I decided to invite two candidates from the very different, from a couple of very different minority parties to debate, the Greens and the Libertarians. And the Greens blew me off. But fortunately, the Libertarians did not. On the line with me to discuss whether the Libertarian Party is in fact better or worse for the worker of America and the workers of the world, I suppose, as well as the employers, than are the major candidates, the Democrats and Republicans, is the person who came in second in the Libertarian race for the presidential nomination here in 2008. She is a former medical school professor. She is the author of the book Healing Our World, Dr. Mary Ruart. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Marty. I'm glad to be here.
Good. Well, libertarians, for those who don't know, believe in primarily that one of maybe their core belief is small government, low taxes, fewer laws, fewer regulations, fewer of anything that's going to restrict the free market. And my first questions are going to focus on the employee, addressing the issue of whether a libertarian administration. Now, of course, my dear listeners, we all know that the libertarians are not going to win, but I think it's important that we look at a perspective here when we're getting a chance to talk to a libertarian, that there is really much of interest that goes on beyond the Democrat and Republican perspectives. Libertarians are really quite different, and so we're going to address the issue of whether a libertarian administration would likely be better for employees, for starters here, than would a Democrat or Republican administration, both of which believe in larger government. So here's the first question. Libertarians want to reduce the size of government, and that's going to mean fewer government jobs available. Well, doesn't that remove the major source of employment for millions of Americans who are unable to land a job or hold a job in the private sector?
Well, actually, it's just the opposite, because when we employ someone in government, we actually take several jobs out of the private sector to do that. And you could see this very clearly in Ronald Reagan's administration, because he actually did cut the number of government employees, specifically regulators. And you could see the number of private sector jobs soar. And when later administrations hired these regulators back, the number of private sector jobs dropped dramatically. You can actually calculate from that each regulator puts about 150 Americans out of work in the private sector. So by decreasing government, we actually increase jobs in the private sector, and we make labor more in demand. So employees benefit because they're going to be paid much more than they otherwise would be.
But doesn't that confuse correlation with causation? Of course, you know, just because Reagan indeed cut the number of government jobs and government regulations, and that at the same time there was an increase, there were many other factors that could explain the increase in private sector employment. Can you make the causal argument for why reducing government jobs actually increases total employment?
Well, sure, Marty, and I'm glad you asked that because, you made a great point. We've got to be careful how we attribute cause. But here's how it works. You know, when we have a regulation in place, these small business people, remember, they create 80% of the new jobs in the private sector. Mm-hmm. The small business people go out of business because they can't comply with the regulations as easily as another company can. For example, in the pharmaceutical industry where I worked for 19 years, as we had more and more regulations, the companies had to merge because what was happening is that, and they laid people off when they did it, of course, and they had to do that because you just don't get you have these regulations, and if you're a small company, you just cannot afford to implement them. Only the big companies survive, and it actually creates kind of a cartel. And in fact, libertarians are the only people helping out small businessmen. For example, there was a big case with the African American hair braiders who were trying to do those little braids throughout the different states, and they were getting put out of business by the cosmetology regulations. Even though they weren't perming hair or cutting it or anything like that, they were being put out of business unless they had a cosmetology license. And the Institute for Justice, which is a libertarian pro bono legal institution, came forward and defended them and won cases in several states so that now that they can practice their craft without having to take a year out of their business and spend $5,000 getting a license that doesn't teach them how to braid.
I'm not convinced that the mergers of major pharmaceutical companies are largely driven by the fact that it's the only way they can survive to meet regulations. I think it's, you know, it may make economic sense for other things. I'm not sure that that argument is persuasive, but I am persuaded by the argument that most of the jobs created in this country, as you said, are created by small businesses. And I know, you know, I'm a career counselor in my day job, and I know how Herculean the barriers are for a small business to be created, the amount of paperwork and regulations that are required are so mammoth that it perhaps more than anything else deters people from starting their small businesses. So that part I agree. You say, though, that only the Libertarian Party helps small businesses. Well, the Small Business Administration, government agency, provides a tremendous amount of help for small businesses. They have the SCORE program where they organize all the retired executives who can then help people. They have loans, small business loans that are available. How can you really say that only the Libertarians are likely to benefit small business?
Well, because when we have a government program, the way we fund those programs is we take money out of the private sector and put it in the public sector. And the public sector, no matter how you know, how much they want to do the right thing, they don't have the market signals that tell them when they're doing the right thing for the most part. You see, a business has profit and loss. It knows when it's pleasing its customers because it makes money. And if it's not pleasing its customers, then, you know, it won't sell anything and it'll show a loss. So it has this price signal to tell them when they're doing a good job. Now, unfortunately, government, no matter how dedicated the people are, don't have this price signal. So they tend to be less efficient. In fact, studies show that the average government program costs about twice as much as the same program in the private sector. So what that means is when we're taking money from the private sector to put in the public sector, we're getting the same service at twice the cost. That's like throwing half the money away. So it's much better to keep these programs, whatever they are, into the private sector. And there are many private sector programs that do help small businesses in different ways. It just depends, you know, which one we're talking about. You know, there's a lot of granting agencies that are funded through the private sector and that I think probably are much more efficient than the government ones.
And it's just, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Please finish.
Oh, and the other part of that is, the biggest part is the regulations that we talked about earlier, because what ends up happening is when what we're having to do is hire government employees to teach small businesses how to jump through these regulatory hoops that you talked about earlier. And that is, you know, that wouldn't have to happen if we didn't have the regulations in the first place. And that's, I think, the point I really want to make, is that most of these government agencies are out there trying to help small businesses get started because they put so many out of business in the first place. And if they didn't put them out of business in the first place, they wouldn't be needed to help them learn how to jump through all those hoops.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. My guest is Mary Ruart. She was the number two candidate. She came in second in her bid to be the presidential nominee for the Libertarian Party. For those of you who are joining, wondering why in the world I'm just having a Libertarian on, indeed, I did invite representatives from the Democrats, from the Obama campaign, from the McCain campaign, and from the Greens. And they did not get back to me. So here we are having a discussion with a Libertarian. Now, you're talking about the regulations, and obviously Libertarians really want to one of their core principles is to reduce regulation in the private sector, which would reduce private sector jobs. For example, countless private sector workers are employed to comply with Sarbanes-Oxley accounting requirements. To meet FDA requirements, drug companies, literally, they ship truckloads of compliance reporting. There are countless jobs that are in the private sector that are created because of these government regulations. Won't a Libertarian administration thus eliminate all those private sector jobs and therefore make it even harder for the American worker?
Well, actually, it's just the opposite, Marty. I know it's not intuitively obvious, so let me kind of go into, again, my pharmaceutical experience. There was a year at the Upjohn Company when I think 90% of our new hires were done to comply with regulations.
Right.
What that meant is that instead of hiring scientists to invent cures for new cures for diseases, they hired regulators to fill out paperwork, which really didn't improve safety or help the American consumer virtually at all.
Why? Why? You would think that all, I mean, that's the
you
purpose
would think.
Of them. Yeah, why don't they improve consumer safety?
Well, that's a very good question. And that's because the marketplace had already done as good a job as it could, so this was excess. And let me give you an example, because I'm very familiar. I've actually made a big study of these regulations.
Okay.
We passed a bunch of regulations in 1962 that really gave the FDA a great deal of power, so much power that it's still busy taking on its power. And because of that, the time for development of a new drug went from about 4.5 years to 14.5 years. So in other words, there's an additional 10 years of development time. Now, you would think that that might help safety, but in fact, studies show it has not. And in fact, what it's done is it's killed people, because now people die waiting because they have to wait an extra 10 years for a new life-saving drug. In fact, cancer patients recently sued the U.S. government saying, we want to buy drugs that aren't fully tested yet because we're going to die waiting. And the U.S. government courts said, no, you have no constitutional right to buy these drugs until the FDA approves them, even if you die waiting. So that was an incredible ruling, and it was appealed all the way up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court refused to hear it. So the lower ruling stands. We cannot buy drugs, even if we're dying. Now, the AIDS patients, I was working on AIDS drugs at the Upjohn Company. When we first got FDA permission to test them in people, every AIDS patient that wanted them in the country had already had them. Why? They hired black market chemists to make the same drugs we were working on, and they distributed them throughout the AIDS community. And I have to say, they did a very good job in terms of safety. And so that's what that delay does. It kills people. In fact, you can calculate how many people it's killed since the 1960s, because we know how many drugs the how many lives the average drug saves. It's 4.7 million people. I mean, that's huge. And to put this in perspective, the number of people before 1962 who would have serious drug side effects, you know, numbered maybe somewhere in the area of something like 1,600 per decade. So even if we saved every single life that would otherwise have been lost to drug side effects, we couldn't come anywhere near that 4.7 million. So what it is the regulations are literally overkill.
I want to not go off on too much of a sidetrack here, because our show is about work, and I want to focus on the issues of the impact of the libertarian philosophy or libertarian policies on the worker. But because I know that you did spend so many years at Upjohn, you were a medical professor at St. Louis University, I do want to ask a couple of follow-up things. First of all, as I understand it, the FDA does have what are called fast-track rules and humane exception rules, so that, in fact, even if a drug has not gone through its, you know, 10 or 14-year, the average 10-year process to reach, you know, phase three of final approval, that patients can have access to the experimental drugs. Isn't that correct?
In theory. In fact, it's very hard to get what we call compassionate use protocols in place. And that's what you're talking about.
Right.
Also, please be aware that the drug company has to give these drugs away. So for the drug company, it's a very expensive process. They have to do a lot of documentation. They have to go to the FDA and ask permission for the patient. And so it's not a cost-free thing. From the drug company's perspective, it's a good PR move, perhaps, but it's a big money loser. So, you know, what the cancer patients were trying to do is saying, look, we're not asking the drug companies to sacrifice, you know, anything here, because we understand that we want them to stay in business. We want them to make a profit so that, you know, they can continue to make our drugs. But we just want to have access to buy them. Shouldn't we have permission to buy them? And, you know, that speaks to every worker in the United States. I mean, if you are not allowed, when you or your loved ones are dying, to buy something that might work for them, you know, then I think that you have a system that is really punishing you.
You know, advocates of the FDA would say, though, you know, corporations unbridled are not exactly benevolent institutions. They are, as you know, as I'm sure you'll readily admit, Their goal is profit, and when profit is the motive, there are tendencies to cut corners. And so left, you know, we all know that, for example, in a more obvious situation where corporations left to their own devices before there were regulations, say, against pollution, corporations, not all, certainly, but many corporations cut so many corners, they were pouring effluent into our rivers that were toxic. So, you know, the advocates of the FDA would say, you know, yes, it takes longer, but we need to have a regulatory process to rein in the profit motive from trumping patient safety. Well, how would you respond to that?
Well, you know, there is such a motive because when something goes wrong with a drug, the courts award damages to the patients, and those are so punitive, especially these days, that, you know, it's not a good idea for a company to put a drug on the market that would hurt people. And to get to your pollution thing, I have to mention here, when I lived close to the Ohio River, I had some women coming and knocking at my door saying, we're going to go talk to the corporations and ask them not to pollute our Ohio River. And I said to them, well, haven't you talked to the EPA? They said, yes, but the EPA isn't interested. They don't want to take this on. And you see, what has happened is when the EPA took on the private property rights for the rivers and things, citizens can't sue anymore. You have to go through the government. So all these ladies were asking me to do was go and help beg the corporations not to pollute. But you see, the problem is when the regulators are in charge, the companies, corporations of any kind, like you say, you know, they can be very greedy. They can go to the government regulators or the elected officials and say, hey, I'll fund your campaign chest if you look the other way, you know, or other mechanisms to what we would call bribe the legislatures. And this is what's happening. And that's what happened on the Ohio River. And that's why the system Britain uses is so much better. You know, in Britain, you can own the private property rights to the fish in the river. And if somebody upstream pollutes, you can sue them and get restitution, which is what they do in Britain. And that's why Britain's streams are much cleaner than ours, because the individual downstream can sue. And that used to be the case and before the government took over suing the polluters. Now that the government is supposed to do it, they don't sue, and they're very selective. In fact, the government is the greatest polluter of all. Our U.S. military is probably the world's greatest polluter. It puts something like three times as much toxic waste in the environment as the three top corporations combined.
You know, you're of course, all human beings are subject to corruption. And in fact, the lack of a profit motive can make government extraordinarily inefficient. But it still doesn't, at least on a logical basis from where I sit, obviate the need for oversight of an entity that might pollute or might produce a drug that hasn't been adequately tested, because of a fear of a lawsuit. I mean, remember when Ford Motor Company, they made a conscious decision. There were no real regulations. They made a decision to put out the Pinto with a cheap anchor to its gas tank, figuring that whatever we had to pay in lawsuits was going to be much less than the profit we'd make by using that cheaper support for the gas tank. And most people, you know, when you're sick, God, you know, let's say you get cancer, you don't, you know, and you hear about this drug, you're not going to be aware that Upjohn had more suits than against it than Lilly or again than Merck. That's most consumers don't have that complete information. So to rely on people's ability to sue to rein in corporations, let's call them excesses, would seem to me not valid. It'd be as inefficient as government is. It would seem to me more likely, and even if it's going to cost twice as much, it would seem to me having a more efficient government. Let's focus our efforts on making government more efficient in monitoring the drug companies, monitoring the car companies, monitoring the corporations that pollute would logically make more sense than simply hoping that American consumers will have the ability to sue. What's your response to that?
Well, actually, Marty, you made a good point. You see, before there were government regulations, it was important to protect your brand name by being a company that didn't get sued. In fact, pharmaceutical companies, again, that's just the area where I happen to know most, used to advertise that our brand of, you know, whatever this vaccine is, has never had a problem with allergic reactions or whatever. They used to advertise that way. And people paid attention to brand name, and especially doctors paid attention to brand names, and they only would utilize companies, you know, the people in the know would only utilize companies who had a great track record. Since the FDA has taken over the evaluation process instead of having better safety, ironically, we've had worse safety. And part of the reason is that the regulations drive this as well. For example, let's say that you discover that a drug that you've had on the market for a long time is a wonder drug for some disease. Like, you know, in fact, aspirin's a good example. You know, we found out that aspirin actually helps certain types of cardiovascular disease patients.
Right.
We knew that back in the 60s.
Hmm.
But because of these new regulations we talked about earlier on your show, when Bayer Aspirin went to the FDA and said, look, we've got this wonderful information. This will help heart disease, the number one killer in the United States. What's it going to take under the new regulations for us to put this on the market? The FDA told them, and they said, we can't do that. It's a generic drug. We won't be able to recoup our, you know, that money that we invest in jumping through all these regulatory hoops. The FDA said, well, too bad. So Americans didn't hear about the wonders of aspirin for cardiovascular disease for another 20 or 30 years because, according to the new regulations, if the Bayer Aspirin Company told physicians about this, the FDA could shut them down. So what we've done is by having regulations that we hoped would help people, we've actually done just the opposite. And I'm only giving one example, but in Healing Our World, my book, mm-hmm. I give thousands of examples, literally, and I reference them so that people can look at it. And what I've concluded is that the ends and means are very intimately related. And when we take choice away from the consumer, in other words, the person who's going to be affected by this should be making the decision. The person who may die if they don't make the right decision is ultimately the one that needs to decide. And when we take that choice away, we have inefficient choices. In other words, when a bureaucrat is deciding which medicine we take, on average, that decision will be worse than the individual. So, you know, again, I don't expect to take my word for it, which is why I recommend to your readers or your listeners, if they want to get a free copy, a free download of Healing Our World, they can just go to my website at ruart.com, ruwart.com, and they can download the free 1992 version, or they can buy the more updated 2003 edition. But, you know, it gives you some examples of how this works in the real world.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. Lest you wonder what the heck we're doing, this is a show about work. I'm talking with the Libertarian who was the leading candidate from the Libertarian Party for the presidency of the United States here in 2008, before another person kind of out-politicked her, if you will. We are talking about, I'll say this. I had originally invited representatives from the Obama campaign, from the McCain campaign, and from the Greens to discuss who is better for the American worker and for the American employer. But although they said they'd get back to me, they didn't. But indeed, the libertarians did, and it is my pleasure to have Mary Ruart talking about it. We've gone off on a little side conversation, which I am now going to rein us back in, about the impact of regulations on the worker, on employment, and on employers. And specifically because she was a longtime employee of Upjohn as well as a medical school professor, and has written a book called Healing Our World about the impact of regulations and big government on the healthcare system. We went off on that sidetrack, but we are now going to go back and talk about the impact of the libertarian approach to politics on the worker. Now, one of the key things that libertarians are involved in on this issue are they're against any minimum wage, let alone raising it. Now, I'm aware of a couple of studies, notably one from Card and Kruger over at Princeton,
mm-hmm.
that find that moderately increasing the minimum wage results in few lost jobs while raising the standard of living for millions of low-wage workers. So aren't libertarians going to hurt the most vulnerable of our workers if we abandon the minimum wage?
Well, again, Marty, it's just the opposite. You know, the study you're citing is one of two, I think, out of hundreds of studies that have shown that. And if you know, of course, if you know anything about statistics, I'm sure you know a lot, you're aware that because of the way of sampling error and things of this nature, that it's actually very unusual to have as good, to have so many studies showing that minimum wage hurts the disadvantaged worker as we have. We probably have hundreds of studies that show it's bad for the employee, and we have two that show it might be okay for some workers. In fact, in Chapter 3 of Healing Our World, I have a graph that shows that when minimum wage was expanded, the number of blacks in the workforce fell proportionately. And again, we got to talk about causation here. So
right.
Let me address that a little bit, because I don't want to, you know, I don't want to mislead anyone here. But basically, what used to happen is that back in the 50s, an employer would obviously prefer to have, in many cases, a white person, because they didn't want to hire blacks. There was more prejudice back then. But the blacks would come forward and say, I'll work for 20 cents less an hour than your white person will. Well, then the employer had a dilemma, because they wanted to save that money, that 20 cents an hour, but they didn't want to employ the black person. So many employers said, okay, I'll let my greed win and I'll hire the black guy. So they would, and the black person would generally outwork the white worker, and then would get other offers from other employers that saw how good, you know, of a deal this was for them, and they'd maybe offer the black person a little more so the black person could go and get a higher wage somewhere else, or, of course, the original employer might decide to pay him or her more just to make sure that he kept them. Now, it's not a good thing that they got paid less, don't get me wrong, but the alternative, the minimum wage, which is the alternative, is that the black person is no longer empowered to make that offer. And so instead of getting paid a little less and having a job where they can grow and keep a job, instead they don't have any job at all. This is especially true for disabled workers. In fact, I was in a situation where I was rehabilitating an apartment building, and I had a young man come up to me and say, hey, I live down the street just a couple houses down, and, you know, he obviously had some physical disabilities. He said, you know I'm not going to be able to work as hard as some of your other workers, but I'll work for a lot less. I'll work for $2 an hour. And this is when the minimum wage in the state I was in was over $3 an hour. And I wanted to hire him, but I was afraid to, because if anyone knew I hired him for that wage, you know, I'd probably be fined. And so I had to tell him no. And that was very sad, because he wanted to work for me. I wanted him to work for me. If he had done a good job, I'd have been happy to pay him more, promote him, whatever. But we didn't get that opportunity. So instead of having a little less pay, he got no pay at all.
The question I'd raise is this. In free market capitalism, the real, I mean, nobody can argue about 20 cents less an hour or whatever. But the reality is that there are many workers whose marginal utility, their marginal value, really could be $2 or $3 an hour. You cannot live on $2 or $3 an hour. You can't even live on $8 or $10 an hour.
That's right.
So if you have, in a free market, if somebody, you're going to give people, quote, the employers the freedom to offer a job at $2 an hour. There are some people who, because they don't want to sit idly, you know, it is better to work for $2. And we all do a tremendous amount of volunteer, retirees do a tremendous amount of work for zero because they don't want to sit idly. They want to feel like productive members of society. But if we allow a free market, won't there be employers who are going to be able to say, hey, well, it's great. This is a low-level job. All it is going to be, you know, something. It's going to be something that's kind of a fun job, relatively interesting. So I'm going to pay them $1 an hour. So what if they can't live? Isn't that going to result in more people being able to live in an unsustainable wage, whereas if, in fact, you have a living wage, 10 or 11 or 12 or 13 bucks an hour, at least, certainly, you're going to restrict people's freedom somewhat, but the millions of people who are going to be able to, who are going to be employed, where the employer is going to say, we can't automate this, this is something we need a human being, there's going to be many more people being able to live on that wage.
Well, actually, no, because what ends up happening is that, first of all, if you actually look at who our low-paid workers are, there's very few of them that are actually trying to support themselves or their family on minimum wage and do so for more than a year. Most of the people that have minimum wage jobs are what we call entry-level people. They're teenagers, they're first-time employees, and or they are spouses getting back into the workforce, or, as you said, retirees, you know, people that really are doing something different for a change. So that's actually not what happens in real life. What happens in real life is the few people that are starting out at a low wage that are serious about moving up in the workforce actually end up doing that very quickly. And so they don't stay at minimum wage. They start at minimum wage. Now, the problem is, or whatever the low wage is. Now, the problem with minimum wage is that it cuts off that entry level for a lot of people that aren't worth the minimum wage. And this is why we have so much black unemployment today. In fact, Walter Williams, a black economist, has pointed to minimum wages as the biggest reason why we have so much black teenage unemployment today, because most black teens can't make that grade compared to the whites. Now, of course, that's speaks to some other things about training our workers in the first place and how blacks are in inner city schools and everything, which, again, would probably not be happening in a libertarian society. That's a whole other issue, I know. But the minimum wage athlete does destroy jobs. You know, we talked earlier about the 100 studies or so that show that minimum wage is destructive and the two that show it isn't. The destruction is in the jobs. What minimum wage does is it destroys jobs, and it destroys them at the entry level so that people can't get their foot in the door. That's what's so important about that. They can't get on-the-job training. So they are left forever out of the workforce.
You know, I want to leave this, but I have to push back one little...
Sure.
You know, as you said, I do know a little bit about statistics. And, you know, it's when you have my PhD from Berkeley is in the evaluation of programs. And so I've grown ever more skeptical about studies that are wide scale, where there are many covariates that could explain what goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And so in areas like that, I tend to trust logic more, a priori logic, more than I do empiricism in studies. And when I think logically, if right now, let's say the minimum wage is $8 an hour, if we, for example, raised it to $10 an hour, I would think that there's only a very small percentage of employers would say, you know what, I'm going to automate this job, or I'm going to do without, or I'm going to whatever. There's going to be a relatively, logically, there is a relatively small number of employees who would lose their jobs or have fewer jobs created. Whereas in contrast, every single one of those, and I do think there are millions of them, and not just senior citizens and teenagers, who are working at or near $8 an hour, whose standard of living would benefit enormously. If you go from $8 to $10 an hour, because they don't pay much tax at that level, they're actually quality of life. They can afford toilet paper as well as tomatoes this month. It would seem to be net to the nation from a utilitarian standpoint would make a big difference in their life. What am I not understanding?
Well, I think the thing that we don't see, and this is the problem when we don't actually look at real data, is that there are factors that haven't been considered. And one of the factors is that if an employer is paying $10 an hour instead of $8 an hour, for them to continue to make the same profit to stay in business, they have to raise the price of their product to consumers. Now, if they do that, you know, like, say, toilet paper. You mentioned toilet paper. So if they raise the price of toilet paper, the people who are buying toilet paper are going to pay that extra charge. So what you've got is you've got some workers benefiting at the expense of others.
Sure.
And who benefits more? Well, if you think about it for a moment, the person who's hurt the most when toilet paper goes up is going to be people that have the very least income. So they're actually going to be paying the price of these extra wages. And if you think about it, want to think about it logically and get a better fix on this, think about it this way. Why $10 an hour? Why don't we just make it $20 an hour? Why not $100 an hour?
No.
So if we make it high like that, then you can easily see what the effect is. You know that a lot of people are going to get laid off.
Sure.
So the bigger we make it, the more people are going to get laid off. So you know that people are going to get laid off at when you raise it from 8 to 10. Now, you say there'll be few, but for those few, I think it's more than few, frankly, but just think of it this way. Let's assume it's few. Those people have now, they go from an income of $8 an hour to an income of $0 an hour. So when toilet paper goes up now as a result, they're hurting even more. So what we're doing is we are giving some people a little more, but we're making a few people pay a very heavy price for that. I mean, they lose their job. That is huge. So that's what I think we're not seeing there, is the devastation that we have to families who actually lose their breadwinner because we've upped the minimum wage.
Right. I want to try one more shot at this, and then I do want to get off this. We fully grant that there's going to be some people who are going to lose their job if we raise the minimum wage from 8 to 10. And you're correct that if we raise it to 10, what's going to happen is the company is either, since all the toilet paper companies are going to be forced to raise their prices a little bit to accommodate this increased wage, what's going to happen is, since toilet paper is used by everybody, because labor only represents a small component of the cost of toilet paper prices, the actual increase in the cost of toilet paper is going to be fairly modest.
Oh, that's not true. Labor is about half the cost. In most instances, labor is half or even more the cost of a product.
Well, I would imagine that if, but it would be another 20 cents on a toy or 10 cents on a cost of a roll of toilet paper, that will cost will be distributed across everybody. But the benefit of that saving will either be, and it might be reduced profits on the part of the company. It is kind of redistributed. Say, you know, the owner of the company in general is doing fairly well, and he can afford to take that 10-cent loss or distribute it to all consumers, rich and poor. But the benefit is going to go to people who can't make a living wage at $8 an hour. So isn't that kind of redistribution ultimately in society's best interest?
Well, not if we have a bunch of people losing their jobs over it, because what it means is that the majority benefit by sacrificing the minority and really sacrificing them. In other words, they don't just stay at $8 an hour. They go to $0 an hour. So you have people going to $0 an hour so that some people who are making $8 can go to $10. That, I mean, like I said, that what you're doing is you're asking some people to bear the entire burden so that other people can benefit. And from a libertarian perspective, because, you know, obviously I'm a libertarian and I come from a libertarian viewpoint, when we do that, what we're doing is we are forcing, literally at gunpoint, because there'll be fines and somebody will eventually go to jail if they don't take these minimum wage laws seriously, we are forcing people at gunpoint to basically fire and devastate some families and basically reduce their lifestyle to nothing, to groveling, in order for a few other people to go from making $8 an hour to $10 an hour, so now that they can have a steak instead of a hamburger, basically. And I find that appalling. I'm sorry, but to put some people out of work so that other people can enjoy a few more benefits, to me, I don't see how anyone with a heart could want to do that.
No, from where I sit, it's a matter where the greater common good accrues. There's going to be people losing their job. My heart reaches out to them, but there would be many more people who would not lose their job and significantly improve their quality of life. Anyway, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Mary Ruart, who was the leading candidate for the presidency of the United States on the Libertarian Party. Didn't quite make it because of, I believe, politics, and I kind of watched this a little bit, and she was, from where I sat, if I can editorialize, the most qualified person in the United States to be the Libertarian Party candidate. We are talking about whether the Libertarian Party, relative compared to the Democrats and Republicans, would be better for the American worker or worse for the American worker. Now, the government we've talked about, has obviously lots and lots of regulations that attempt to ensure worker safety. For example, those that are policed by OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and here in California, California OSHA. Plus, there are local workplace safety laws. And those laws and policies have, for example, set limits on how much carcinogenic material can be in the workplace's air. It mandates that table saws have safety mechanisms to keep people from losing their arms at work. And they prohibit child labor. Would any of that change under a libertarian administration, which normally believes in small government and fewer regulations?
Well, yes, I think it would change. One of the things that I saw recently was a study on accidents before and after OSHA. And surprisingly so, there were more accidents after OSHA.
Why?
Why? Well, because OSHA focuses, OSHA, like many government agencies, often focuses on what I would call the wrong things. In other words, what they do is they come and say, okay, you need this safety measure and this safety measure, but oftentimes what they're doing is neglecting a safety measure that is really important because they don't know the business, for example. Generally, businesses, they don't want a poor safety record because, of course, if they're having work-related injuries, their workers' compensation goes way, way up. So they have a lot of incentive to make sure that their workers are in a safe environment. And because they know the industry, for example, they will do the things that will save the most lives. But if OSHA comes in and says, no, you have to put that money that you're going to try to save lives with in this area instead of this area, if OSHA makes the wrong decision, which frequently they do, then what ends up happening is instead of investing in the right safety equipment, they invest in the wrong safety equipment. So this has been a problem. In fact, I hate to keep coming back to the FDA, but that's the agency I know the best.
Sure.
I actually had the support of Dr. Ron Paul, a congressman from Texas, to apply for the FDA commissioner position when it opened up. And Ted Kennedy, who was heading the committee that needed to approve that appointment, basically said, we can't have anyone who's ever been in the pharmaceutical industry running the FDA. So in other words, we have, and then consequently the person who got the job was from veterinary practice and didn't know anything about, clearly did not know anything about drug regulation, because he got up at a meeting and said, yeah, it's really sad that we don't have more innovation and that it takes so long for drugs to go through the process. You know, we only take 1 year to review the data, so it's not our fault. It's this 14 years that it takes the company to get the data to us. Well, he clearly didn't realize that the FDA sets the regulations that creates this 14-year timeline. And, you know, if you have regulators in place who don't know the industry, they're going to do things that actually harm people and harm the industry, and I believe that's been the case at OSHA.
Well, there's no question that, industry knowledge can help, and there's no question that government is inefficient, and even the most liberal, even Obama, would agree that we need to be more efficient and effective in government. But it's still, to say that the self-regulation is going to work would mean that right now we have no child labor in this country because it is believed that there are laws that say it is unfair to children to subject them to have them work. They're not at the age of consent. We have far less carcinogenic materials in our steel factories and the like. Table saws used to, when corporations were left to their own devices, they bought the cheapest table saws that didn't have these elaborate mechanisms that would keep workers from having their arms cut. Sure that there are cases where industry knowledge is helpful, but anybody with half a brain would know that you shouldn't have carcinogenic air. It needs to be, cost-benefit needs to be limited. What's wrong with that?
Well, Marty, let me address that, because the carcinogenic thing is another thing where government, again, doesn't seem to know the facts of the matter. We're so busy trying to decrease carcinogens in different foods and stuff, but, what's really hilarious about that from a scientific viewpoint, or actually not hilarious because it costs so many lives, is that we eat many more natural carcinogens that occur in food than that we can possibly take out. The decreasing carcinogens is sort of a joke in the scientific community because we eat so many of them, and there's no way not to because plants produce them as their natural pesticides. So, this is, like I said, this is kind of a joke the way this is being done. But what it's doing, it's diverting money that could better be used for other safety things. And I'm not saying there shouldn't be any regulation. I'm saying marketplace regulation is very effective. That's why companies don't want their workers to be hurt, because their insurance premium goes up, and that's more expensive for them than putting the safety equipment in. You mentioned child labor, too, and I really want to talk about that. That's really an important topic. A lot of countries today still have child labor, and the reason they do is for the same reason that we used to have it, because when you have a country that isn't prosperous, when it's not creating enough wealth, then everybody works or they don't eat, and that's what used to happen in the early days of the Industrial Revolution. Every child worked. They worked on a farm. That's where most of our children were, and they had to, because if they didn't, then the farm didn't succeed, and they didn't eat. So that was because we didn't know how to. We didn't have the equipment that we have today. We didn't have the ways of farming we have today. We didn't have the wealth creation that we have today. So there wasn't a lot of wealth created. That's what had to happen. Now, as we got wealthier, then our children could go to school. They didn't have to work. And that's how child labor actually decreases. If you do a study of third world countries today, what you find is that as these countries get wealthier, child labor decreases, whether or not it's there's laws about it, because people want their children to go to school rather than to have to work in general. I mean, that's the general thing. There are exceptions, obviously. So child labor happens when it's necessary. And in third world countries where they've tried to ban child labor when there wasn't enough wealth creation, what happens, the children still work. But now, because they're in the black market, if something goes wrong and they're mistreated, they have no recourse. They can't go to the law and say, hey, this person just beat me up, because, that was their employer and they weren't supposed to be there in the first place. So now they can't even, sue the person that really hurt them. And so, it's really important to understand this concept of wealth creation and understand why children work. They work because they need to eat. So, when we had child labor laws in the United States, it didn't come about because all of a sudden, you know, people were feeling good about not having children work. It came about because we had enough wealth that children didn't have to work, and some people tried to reinforce this by law, but they didn't have to. The trend was already there. Fewer children were working because parents were sending them to school instead. So the law was redundant, and it's not the law that was responsible for ending child labor. It was the creation of wealth at such a rate that children no longer had to work.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Mary Ruart. She was the leading candidate for the Libertarian Party presidential nomination until she was, let's just say, beaten out by another person. But we are talking about, and frankly, my listeners, those of you just joining me, as I've said, I invited representatives of both the Obama and McCain campaigns, as well as the Greens and the Libertarians, to appear to discuss who's going to be best for the American worker. But it is only the Libertarians that responded, and so that is why we are just talking with Mary Ruart, who represents, obviously, the Libertarian perspective. Now, the government subsidizes with either carrots or sticks, either, you know, like you said, the gun to your head or various incentives. The government subsidizes many private sector jobs, for example, for the disabled. People who in the free market couldn't land a job, or displaced homemakers, there are programs, or for veterans, or underrepresented minorities. Now, wouldn't they be hurt by the Libertarians who believe in minimal government intervention in employment?
Well, no, because you see, what would happen is we'd create so many jobs that labor of any kind would be in demand. If you remember in World War II, when all the boys went off to fight, all of a sudden, there was a demand for labor, but who was going to fill it? Well, they called the women in, who historically, you know, didn't have these kind of jobs. You saw Rosie the Riveter, and the women did quite well. What that shows is that when there's a demand, the people who are normally disadvantaged in today's job market have a really good chance of getting a job. And that's really the blessing of a libertarian society, is that, you know, job creation really should be unlimited. And the only reason that we have limitations on jobs today is because of all this government regulation. As you yourself were talking about earlier, how small businesses are really hurt, and they're the big job-creating engine of the country. And, in fact, the disabled, interestingly enough, seem to do better when the private sector tries to utilize their labor. In fact, right there in California, in Roseville, California, there's a group called Pride Industries. And it was initially warehousing disabled clients. According to, you know, their charter, that's what they did. They were trying to help them that way. But they decided they wanted to make sure that they could work like regular people. So they just started training them for jobs and got them high-paid jobs so that they not only had the disabled making all this money for themselves, but Pride Industries itself became very profitable and helped people out. And, of course, when you look at the faces of these people, I mean, they're just so excited because, you know, they're back in the workforce in a real job. Now, today, what we do is, you know, we subsidize them. And, you know, to some extent, I think that would really hurt a person's self-esteem to think that they can't get a job in the marketplace without being subsidized. I think that's pretty tragic. I think a much better way is to train them to actually hold down a good job and have an economy that wants them. You know, today the economy doesn't really want such people, and that's why we have to subsidize them. And I find that very sad.
You know, early in the show, you made the argument that why minimal government involvement, minimal government regulation was the key to creating a large number of greater jobs. And you're saying here that if we eliminated a lot of the regulations, reduced a lot of the taxes, reduced the size of government, you're saying that there would be enough jobs created to create an adequate market for the disabled, for displaced homemakers, for veterans, for underrepresented minorities. For those who are just joining us, because you've been on now for about 45 minutes, make briefly, because we're now starting to run out of time, briefly make the most compelling argument you can for why that indeed would create a large number of more additional new jobs.
Certainly. Well, what happens when we have a regulation that says, okay, business, now you have to do this, whatever that this is, what ends up happening is these small businesses have a harder time complying than big businesses that have, you know, a larger profit.
And you said that 80% of the jobs created in this country are private sector jobs are created by small business.
That's right. So, you know, we're talking about the major part of the jobs here. So what we do is we regulate, we put people out of work, and again, you can calculate it from data that exists that about the average regulator destroys about 150 private sector jobs a year. And we have thousands of regulators. So if you get rid of this dampening of the job creation engine, you start having lots and lots of jobs. And if you think about it for a minute, logically, like you were talking earlier, Marty, it makes total sense because, you know, anybody can look around and say, hey, people need something like this. I can do this. I can have a business that does this. And they go out and they start a business that provides a service, for example. So jobs are unlimited. There's no limit to how many jobs there should be. The only reason we have limitations is because we have government demanding that as an employer we have to do certain things that doesn't help productivity and generally hampers it. And again, we've had a number of cases. I actually would like to invite your listeners to go to the Institute for Justice's website, ij.org, and look at all the cases they've taken on where small businesses are being put out of business by big government. And this is a libertarian nonprofit organization that does pro bono work for these people, takes on these regulations and allows these people to work. And if you look at the pictures, most of them are minorities. So, you know, these are the people who really get hurt are our minorities. And in fact, when the taxi industry gets deregulated in a city, what you find is that whereas before the deregulation there were not any minority owners of cabs, after that you usually have most of the cabs being owned by minorities, because driving a cab, driving your own car as a taxi, is one of the easiest ways for a person to get into profit-making business for themselves inexpensively. And yet, in many cases, for example, in New York City, you've got to pay $200,000 and up for the privilege of driving your own car as a taxi cab. So what poor person can afford that? So all these jobs are being destroyed, and if we stop destroying them, we would have a demand for labor. You see, labor's hurting now. Employees are hurting now because there's not a demand for employees. And that's what we have to change. If we really want to help the American worker, we've got to expand the job market. The easiest way to do it is to deregulate it. And countries that have done this have become economic miracles virtually overnight.
Can you give me an example? I mean, hard. Where's a country that's been where a very small government exists? Because as far as I know, it's countries that have reduced the size of government, like Russia has, or Mexico. You've got countries with extraordinarily big gaps between rich and poor, where there's cronyism and corruption are rife. Where are the examples of countries that have very small governments where there's been this great expansion as a result of jobs?
Yeah, Mexico and the Russia are not examples of that. They are top heavy still in government.
Right.
They have less than they had, but not much less.
Oh.
And
yeah.
The countries that have done this and done it in a big way were Great Britain in the 80s. They slashed all of a sudden, and their GDP, their gross domestic product.
Slashed what? You said England slashed, and you didn't say what they slashed. They slashed
taxes,
the size of government and taxes.
Yeah,
okay.
Taxes, regulation, and tariffs are usually the three things that people get. And in New Zealand, in the late 80s, early 90s, did the same thing. They became called an economic miracle. And Ireland has done the same thing. And I think it was in the 90s. I'm not remembering exactly when they did that. And people were really surprised when Ireland did it, because Ireland historically has been, you know, considered to be a poor country that has no hope. So, but there's a formula you can use. I mean, it's not a state secret or anything. It's out there on the internet. All you have to do is slash taxes, size of government, you know, basically government spending is what it is. You have to slash government spending, taxes, and tariffs. And if you do that, what happens is your economy booms, jobs become plentiful, and your gross domestic product or wealth creation, however you want to measure it, goes way, way up, and the standard of living in that country goes up. Now, in all these three countries, when that happened, they had this period of time where they had this great boom, and then what happened is government came back in and started to re-regulate and tax more, and, of course, they lost their edge. It's the same thing that happened to our country. That's why our country became so wealthy. It was because they had more freedom, or less government, if you will, than other nations, and so we became a very wealthy country, and now we're hurting. We're starting to have a bad economy because we're regulating more, we're taxing more, and as long as we continue that, our economy is going to go down, and the person who's going to get hurt is the employee. They are really going to get slammed. So if we want to help employees, we've got to have a job market where we have a demand for labor.
As we discussed earlier, I am a little nervous about such broad-brush characterizations when there's so many covariates. I mean, we saw a major expansion of the economy during the Clinton years, where, in fact, we had government expand. Of course, we also did have an expansion in the conservative Reagan time. So, you know, there's just so many covariates. I hate to look at, say, this, you know, Ireland did this in these 3 years, and it boomed, and let's move to...
Well, they did it purposefully, Marty. I want to tell you that all these countries did this purposely to get the effect that they did. And, you know, the remedy, of course, I agree with you, you should be skeptical. That's why I put, like, over 1,000 references in Healing Our World. But, you know, the remedy for this is we should be talking more about these kind of topics, as you're doing. I'm glad you're doing this on your show, because we need to talk more about this so we, you know, can all be on the same page as to a solution.
Let's, we're almost out of time here. You know, one of the other roles of government has been to create laws and policies to deal with things like sexual harassment, mm-hmm. discrimination in employment, wrongful termination. You know, if would a libertarian administration do anything to rescind those laws?
Well, I think, you know, again, I think we feel that the marketplace regulates that pretty well. And I can tell you, again, stories. You know, when the problem is that when you have things like affirmative action, for example, and someone is hired under that program, they start out with a strike against them. You know, their coworkers think that they only got hired because of the color of their skin or their sex or something like that. And so they... You know, they don't want to cooperate as much. They're skeptical of their skills. I saw this at Upjohn. And I felt myself, as a research scientist, as an all-male profession when I started back in the 70s, my affirmative action program for me was just to outcompete all my colleagues so that a company would look at me and say, well, she's a woman, but if we don't hire her, our competition will, and then we'll be in real trouble. And that worked actually pretty good. And I think that really is the best program to stop discrimination, is simply to show how good you are.
No, it's great. However, I mean, we've all heard stories, for example, of women who were groped by men, and it was only things like, you know, or where there really was an old boys club that ensured that people like to hire people who are like themselves, so they hired other white males, etc. Mm-hmm. And it's not like I'm some big liberal here, my job here is to kind of be the polite skeptic. You know, if it weren't for those laws, I would imagine there'd still be a lot more groping and a lot more old boys network. I'm equally incensed about the new girls network that is equally exclusionary and reverse discrimination in hiring. But, you know, mm-hmm. if it weren't for those laws, I'm wondering whether we really would be worse off.
Well, as far as the groping goes, now, that's a little different. I mean, if somebody actually touches you, you know, I guess you could, from a libertarian standpoint, I think if you have unwelcome hands on you, I mean, and they don't stop when you say no, that you definitely consider that a form of assault. So I think that could definitely be actionable in a libertarian society. As far as, but you know, you talked about the old boy network, and that is true. You know, what women did is exactly what blacks did, though. They would work for a little less, and they'd get their foot in the door, and then they'd show how good they were, and then the employer had to make a decision to pay them more or lose them to a competitor. And that's probably, I know that that's not an instant remedy, but it's probably the best remedy, because the laws that we have on the books now aren't an instant remedy either. What they actually do is they put professional women and professional blacks into good positions at the cost of their less professional sisters and brothers. Because what happens is the government has to spend money on these affirmative action programs, and it, of course, because...
I've got to interrupt you because I've pushed this too long. We're out of time. So I want to thank you. I'm so sorry I have to end so abruptly. I have to thank you, Mary Ruart, who is was the leading candidate for the Libertarian Party. We're talking about the implications of libertarian policies for the worker. For those people who'd like some more information locally, there is lpsf.org, which is the Libertarian Party of San Francisco.org, lpsf.org. Her book, Healing Our World, and libertarian.meetup.com/370 if you want to go to a meetup group that meets monthly, libertarian.meetup.com. Mary Ruart, Dr. Mary Ruart, I want to thank you very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you, Marty, and maybe we can do this again sometime.
I would enjoy it. My thanks to my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course to all of you for listening. Next week I will promise to do 3-minute career makeovers on callers, and I will talk with Carol Casella, author of Oxygen, on what it's really like to be an anesthesiologist, the scientific and emotional complexities that a doctor and patient face in the operating room. I'm really looking forward to it. Till next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you of what Einstein said. Great spirits have always encountered violent opposition from mediocre minds.